Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Episode 14, a conversation with Henning Böcker, professor at the University of Bonn and the German Center for Neurodegenerative Disease in Bonn, collector of art and co-founder of the space Sauvage in Düsseldorf. Hello, Henning. Very nice to have you.
Hey, Daniela. Nice to speak to you.
I would like to start with first asking you about your job. You're the research group leader at the University of Bonn and professor for functional neuroimaging. You have to tell us later a little bit about this. I met you as an art collector, and you're the co-founder of the independent art space Espace Sauvage with Monika Leier-Pritzko. But could you first explain a little more about your research? What are you doing exactly?
As it comes to the profession, some of the things you mentioned are really occupations I have or where I like to invest time and energy in the art field. But my work, as you said, is related to clinical functional neuroimaging. And I have two positions in Bonn, one at the university, as you mentioned, and the other one is at the German Center for Neurodegenerative Disease. So the word clinical functional neuroimaging actually already implies that the work is very much related to diseases of the central nervous system. So diseases you can encounter in neurology or psychiatry. And the imaging, in a way, goes beyond the normal imaging sequences that are applied for clinical diagnosis. We use at the systems level, so really covering the entire central nervous system, modern neuroimaging techniques, some you may have heard of, like magnetic resonance imaging, but also techniques in the field of nuclear medicine, like positron emission tomography. And these techniques allow us to study brain function in vivo, in the living human while he's in the scanner. And the clinical component of this work and this research work is to use these techniques to better understand the origin of certain clinical disease conditions. And it's a very interesting and in a way also revolutionary approach in medicine, because these techniques are extremely sensitive. And they are in a way revolutionary, I would say, as they really change the whole idea of a disease, because particularly in the field of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, we can use these biomarkers to identify disease conditions long before the first clinical symptoms arise. And so we are really at a turning point where we define disease in a very different way as compared to 20, 30, 50, or 100 years ago, where patients would go to the doctor, complain about symptoms, and then one would do certain examinations and come to the conclusion that the patient is suffering from a certain disease. This is changing, especially in diseases which have a very long preclinical period. And we can really identify these diseases before first symptoms arise. And this is in a way ambiguous, because of course this only makes sense if we can offer treatments which allow us to intervene in a very early time point. But this is not always given. That's more or less what these techniques allow us to do. This is a field called molecular imaging. So we can talk about maybe Alzheimer's disease, really identify with radioactive tracers, certain protein depositions in the brain as were discovered 100 years ago under the microscope. But post-mortem, of course, by Alois Alzheimer, like tau and amyloid plaques, but we can now identify these proteins in the brain of patients while they are living and even before they have symptoms.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So at least even if there's not a cure for those illnesses like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, they can be probably delayed if you identify it early?
That's the big hope. They could either be cured, or that's probably more realistic, at least in the current situation, delayed. And other large component of my work is really related to resiliency mechanisms, protection, prevention of disease. And we know how certain lifestyle factors affect the brain in the worst for instance, sedentary behavior, if you don't move, if you don't do any exercise, but we could encourage people at risk in early stages to do the things from which we know that they really help the brain and hopefully prolong the period until first symptoms appear. But there are also a lot of developments in the pharmaceutical field with antibodies, where we hope that we will use these techniques later to identify subjects at risk before their brain has undergone tremendous changes, as in the later stages of Alzheimer's disease, and then to intervene in a much earlier phase and hopefully more efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And have you been first interested more in the human aspects of these things when you studied medicine, or have you been more interested in the more technical aspects?
That's a good question. Actually, nobody has asked me that. I think, first of all, while I was studying medicine, I was very lucky. I was able to study also in France. And during that time, I knew very early that I wouldn't like to do this, that I wouldn't like to do that, that that would absolutely not be what I would like to do, especially surgery and things like that. And in the same time, I developed this interest in the human brain. I found this the most exciting organ, which of course is related to our thinking, our conception of the world and everything. And at the same time, I thought the best approach to better understand the brain is to do this on a holistic level, mm-hmm. meaning there are people who go with very fine needles into very small parts of the brain, and it's extremely specific because they can characterize neurons or very small areas of the brain. But the interesting thing in my field is that we really cover the entire brain. So we, depending on the resolution of these scanners, we are talking about 50,000 or more boxes, so volume elements, which contain, of course, different cell types. But we really cover the entire brain. And if you want to study disease conditions, you can look really at neuronal networks, at the interconnection between brain areas. And this is extremely interesting in this field. So there's rather a choice of the resolution and the specificity with each method you use in science. But I find this field extremely interesting. And actually, you may know this famous journal Science in Nature. They once in a while also publish review articles about the contribution of different techniques. And one is really this field of functional magnetic resonance, where we really study neuronal activity with special MR sequences without using any contrast agents. And there's a picture of the MR scanner or the brain, or you see the curves of the employment of these techniques, and it's really rising very steeply as compared to other techniques, which is also due to the availability, but also the tremendous potential.
Mm-hmm. And also the interesting thing is that you work with the living brain. I know that you told me once that you think there is no direct relation probably between this and your interest in art. I really wanted to ask you if you think that your interest in the functioning of the human brain is connected with your interest in the thing that the human brain creates. And one of the things the human brain creates is not only science, it's also art.
I think there are at different levels interconnections. And the one you mentioned is a very obvious one. What I at the time tried to explain to you is that my personal interest and the research we're doing in my group is not so much related directly to this topic. Mm-hmm. There are researchers who are interested in music processing. For instance, Robert Sartori, he has an entire center which is called BRAHMS in Toronto, and it's a huge building, research building, and they are mainly focusing on the effects of music on the brain. And it could also be imaginable that I would choose this as a research profile or interest, but this was actually never the case. I think that the artistic experience is extremely individual and, in a way, so to speak, from a scientific standpoint, very difficult also to standardize. So you may have seen in journals some pictures which are bullet pointing the results of our studies, where you see blobs in certain brain areas. And these are always group data. So involving 20, 30, 50, or even more subjects to really have very stable results. And my personal approach to the art field, I think it's possible with these techniques to do very fundamental studies which have to do with color processing, maybe abstract versus concrete, things like that. Mm-hmm. But where I'm as a human especially interested, or as an person who likes to have this art experience, this is something which is very, very individual. I can say for myself that I can have in certain circumstances physiological responses, which are definitely also driven by the brain, by my reward system, maybe also the release of certain neurotransmitters, similar to what you can encounter in musical experience or other experiences. Mm-hmm. But I also think that my taste, my interest is very much driven by my previous experiences, and that's a very long process. And I think each and every individual you would put in such a study would have a different profile, and would be very difficult to come to robust conclusions in that field. So I think at the basic level, yes, that's possible. And a very famous neuroscientist, Professor Singer, he was the director of the Max Planck Institute in Frankfurt. He is now founding director of a Max Planck Institute for Neuroaesthetics. And I think that's the kind of work they are doing. As an art collector, you know, I see something, or I'm interested in a certain artist, and then I see a work which overwhelms me, maybe because I don't understand it, or because there is something which is difficult for me to read or to understand, both on the aesthetic level or also on the formal or the meaning level. But that's a very individual experience.
That leads directly also to one thing I would be interested in, or actually it's two. One is, how did you become interested in art, and what was the first artwork you acquired? And then the second part of the question would be, what does an artwork need to have in order to get your attention and finally your wish to buy it?
You want to know the initiation.
Yes, the initiation, exactly.
The initiation point. I was in school in Kaiserswerth in Düsseldorf, and not so much my art teachers, but actually my German teacher. When I was about 15 or 16, he was a writer, and he then became a teacher at our school. And he had a very interesting theme for 1 year. And one major aspect was Dadaism. And he introduced us to Tristan Tzara, Hugo Ball, Kurt Schwitters, and artists like that. And there was a very funny situation. I was asked to present a Dadaistic poem, Gaji Beri Bimba in Sala. You may know this. So the book he gave me, it's a famous book on Dadaism from his own private library, was circulating in the class, so I was basically missing the text. And then he said, oh, no problem, just rip off the cover. So I was able to tear out a page of the book, and the book was circulating in school. And that was somebody who really influenced me at that time with 15, 16. I must also say that my father was always interested in modern and also contemporary art. So I had access to his library, also in a very privileged sense. I'm very grateful for that. At the time, we had the Schopstorff'sche Buchhandlung on the Königsallee, and he had an account, and he said, so if you see a book you're interested in, just take it and just put the name on this account. So that was a very privileged situation. And then this initiation really took place when I was 16, and I saw an exhibition with my father, actually, in Stuttgart, and it was the retrospective of Francis Bacon. And that was a very physical experience I had, and that was such a boom, and it really struck me at the time. And then you wanted to know which was the first work. I actually started off in the classical field, so I had a good job in university, quite a lot of money on the weekends, and I bought my first lithograph by Antonio Tapies. But then this whole change, I wanted to be connected with artists of my generation, and then this whole process changed.
And how did you then get in touch with the artists of your generation, and what is that, what an artist or an artwork does to have that really triggers your interest?
I was very happy to meet artists. At that time, I was living in Munich, and a lot of artists all over Germany at the time around the turn of the century and even 2 years before, they moved to Berlin. And I was able to see how they installed themselves in Berlin. I was very frequently in Berlin in their studios. And there also, I realized very early that there is an interrelationship, that these artists were interested in my research. So that is a connection. But I must say, it's a whole process. So what you're asking me, this changes over time. I actually never sold any of the works I acquired, but it is nevertheless a process. And I was interested also in installative works. And I must say, in a way, I was really struck by works which, first of all, appeared to me as difficult, something which I would not understand immediately. In painting, I had a favor for bad painting. So really, I'm now talking about the generation, my generation, but, you know, painters who are in the tradition of Kippenberger, Büttner, and Günter Förg, I would say, but was a younger generation. So that's interesting, was interesting for me. And then a lot also installative works where you would enter completely a separate world, I think is still extremely interesting for me.
So it's a process. So are you really then learning about the things? Are you getting to know the artists or the galleries personally? Is this an important part of the process that you're more involved?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have a certain connection with galleries, gallerists, and of course, artists, some which are private heroes of mine. Unfortunately, I did not have the chance to meet, like I would have liked to meet Mike Kelly, for instance, or Paul Teke or Paul McCarthy. But yeah, I met Dan Braham. That was very illuminating for me. We spent a whole weekend together. But as I said, my connection is more related to younger artists. And there I have, over the years, very intense relationships, which hold now for more than 20 years.
More or less recently, you opened first in Bonn and now in Düsseldorf, Espace Sauvage, which extends your own collection, which is not necessarily showing your collection.
No.
What was the driving force behind that? Why did you have the need to do an exhibition space?
I wouldn't say that there was a need to. Sauvage is actually also a process. And I wanted to, because one thing we haven't talked about, while I was living in Bonn in the last 10 years, I was also heavily involved in supporting the Bonner Kunstverein as a director of a really great space, fantastic curators. And that was also a big source of inspiration for me. But that is something which now is finished this year, because I had to choose how to invest my energy. And so collecting is something which has its own logic here with Sauvage. We are completely free in selecting artists that we find interesting, some artists which we do not yet know very well. And it's like an experience which you engage yourself in. And it's a very private thing between the artists and us. We basically let them do what they want to do in the space. And so far we have realized 8 or 9 exhibitions in total. And already now I can say that each and every of these exhibitions for us was a very interesting process, and we had a very good feedback so far. So there it's really about realizing an idea of an artist, to give him the space and to see what comes out of it. If you collect art, you usually see works which are already finished. You somehow think how this relates to your collection. And here it's something where you see the result at the end of this process. And that's a different approach. And I think it's extremely inspiring and interesting.
You're involved in the process, what is happening in the space, obviously. And you find it an inspiring and also a learning process. And did your approach as a collector, did that change through this exhibition space?
Not so much due to the exhibition space. I think this is complementary. It's different. And as I said, working for the Bonner Kunstverein means helping the curator to realize their own program. There you have inspiration by their work. Collecting has the dynamic which comes from the collection. So basically, I mean, it's all an imaginary space. It happens in your head unless you have a huge exhibition space where you can put up your collection and see it. So it's very abstract in a way. You know how things are related to each other, but it's all happening basically in your brain. So we come actually back to the beginning of our discussion. And now this space is very procedural, interesting, as we have a change every 2 to 3 months, and it's an experience. You know, we invite the artists to be with us, we cook together, and it's a lot of fun, and as I said, very inspiring. I love it, and I think all of these things are in a way complementary.
And how do you choose the artist?
We know we are located here in Düsseldorf. We want to show artists which have not a representation here, which have possibly not shown in the city or in the Rhineland area. And I think we select artists which are in a way a little bit offset, not with major gallery representations, so artists which are still in the process of developing their career. I'm not saying that this will always happen. We may also work together with galleries or also with collectors, actually. With collectors is another possibility, but it has to have an added sense. For instance, if an artist would have a show nearby and we would show a very specific aspect, which is a little bit off the commercial side, that could be interesting to us. But one example, we showed Özlem Altin. She's somebody who is already very much on the radar of certain curators. She was showing in different biennales, the Berlin Biennale, but also the Istanbul Biennale. Now she's Villa Romana, but she has no gallery representation currently. And for us, after her exhibition, was really fantastic to see that we showed them in this very small space. But now she is also having huge success with future exhibitions in the US. I think this is very nice. We see that. I think it's a little bit boring to, you know, take artists who are represented by 20 galleries and then also to show them in such a space. There's no added need.
So you're also like a platform for support and to be a partner of the artists.
Absolutely. So, like as a collector, I think collecting is not about assembling works for your own. It's always a decision also to support artists. And collecting is interesting in you do this at a point where nobody can really guarantee how the development of an artist will pursue. And I must say, I really never cared about this development. And I was always, you know, collecting also in the depth, so really trying to artworks from different periods, different developments. And some artists are simply not successful because they are also a bit radical and not willing to do certain compromises. And but I never cared about that as long as the works convinced me.
Does that resonate with you? Because that's kind of the type of person you also are. Wanting to do really your thing and not making so many compromises?
I think I'm in a very happy situation being able to work in a field in science where nobody tells me you have to do this or you have to do that. So that is very important, of course, for me. And I think that a collection or any engagement in this art world, of course, reflects also the type of character you are, sure.
Mm-hmm. So you said your collection is something which happens more in your head because you're not able to show or see the works at the same time. Does that mean they're all in storage?
A lot is in storage. And I had the chance to show parts of it twice, actually, in Berlin, the Kunstsäle, and in another space. That was very interesting for me, you know, to deal with the space and to involve the artists. And this was a great experience for me.
That's something you're not necessarily planning to find something where you could put your collection on display?
Currently not, no. Currently I'm really absorbed with, you know, this process of really thinking about our new exhibitions in the Sauvage space. And there are a lot of things which have to be dealt with. I'm actually trying to be there always on Saturdays between 11 and 3. Although now, even when I'm not there, we have very nice replacement. And sometimes also Monica steps in. But as you can imagine, we have to organize transport, the openings. So this is really a big source of inspiration. And we're very much working on continuing this type of work. And we have actually some very concrete plans also for next year.
Yeah. And did these plans change during the lockdown and during this phase since Corona, or is that not really important for developing?
Of course, I mean, Corona, I just had an artist, a visitor with whom I talked this morning in the Sauvage space, and he said, well, with Corona, everything has changed. And I basically agree, we had to change a lot. This happened, basically our lockdown happened on the evening after the opening. On the 13th of March, we basically decided to close down. And even on the 13th, we were very prudent, you know, only letting certain people in the space. But then we, first of all, decided to extend the exhibition until the gallery weekend. And then I discussed with Benoit Cateus, he's a Belgian artist from Brussels, to basically change the show completely. So we first showed some photography installations, or basically installations with photography. And now the second part of this exhibition is a pure painting show. And I like this very much, this change, because it shows different facets of the artist. And now with the DC opening in September, we are back to schedule, but not only with respect to the space. I'm very prudent also as a physician in the way these things will change our life. And I'm quite doubtful that everything will come back into normal order very soon.
Mm-hmm. As a physician, what would be your advice?
The advice is to stay prudent, to convince people who think they can take it as an easy thing, like any normal virus. We don't know anything about the follow-up consequences, even in those people who had no symptoms while they had the virus. We know that immunological processes are entrained by the virus. We do not know that it can affect not only the lungs, but also the heart muscle, and also the liver. And we don't know anything about the really long-term consequences. And in a more general way, I think that this virus really basically like a mirror, or it interferes into a worldwide process of globalism, and it basically shows us the weaknesses of the system. So before Corona or COVID-19, we already had severe doubts about the future, both in ecological and economical terms. Where will this all lead to if we always believe that the market, the economy will regulate everything? And Corona now shows us that it distributes in the same patterns like we do this global economy. And I think it really shows us the weakness of our system, the fragility of life. I don't want to dramatize this, but I have also heard that there are other viruses which potentially can hook on these viruses. And I think we don't really know exactly how to handle. So as a scientist, I'm extremely prudent, because so far it's all very instant research, how many people get affected in a certain area or so. We do not yet know exactly what it means, what are the long-term consequences, including the young people. And I also think, because of the economical burden, there is a lot of pressure also on scientists from the political side, you know, to come up with data. And sometimes good science needs time. And so I think all this is not solved. And anybody who says, well, he can foresee that the problem will be solved next year, in my view, is lying.
It definitely obviously has very negative sides. But is there something where you think, yeah, that could be a positive outcome? Or what could we learn from that situation? What would you wish be the outcome of all of this?
Actually, I had the chance last week to listen to one of your podcasts by a musician, which I like a lot, by Hauschka. And I think he was basically also thinking about this idea that people think they need everything at every time and everywhere. I think that Corona basically is now an alarm signal telling us that we should think about what we really need, where we have to step down and say, okay, I don't need to travel. We can replace this by electronic communication. And a lot of the things we were used to are not necessary. And I think we have a large responsibility for also future generations. And I think this is now the time to think about what can we change. And we just come to the art scene again. I can imagine if you restrict your room for 2 or 3 people, but then the gallerist is present, there can be a very intense discussion with a few people. And this can be a very unique experience as compared to the usual full house, party type thing where people have very superficial conversations. So I think, as with everything, you can have difficult situations, but sometimes they also show you the path to change something, which could be and hopefully be a better outcome.
Absolutely. Last question. Do you think artists could be especially well equipped to deal with that situation?
I wouldn't like to generalize. I think why I like to talk and discuss with artists is that these are usually people with very sensible antenna, radar systems. So they experience things in our society in a way that normal people would simply don't do. So I think that they also envision changes. Yeah, I can imagine that they envision changes of society, that they have the urge to show things or that they have to deal with things that they encounter in their life. But they are also sensible persons in a way. And we also see from the medical side that a lot of people, I'm not talking about artists in general, but we see in our society that certain people have difficulties in coping with this lockdown, with the restriction. And we also see that there is an increase in certain disease conditions also of the human brain, in psychiatry, depression, and so on. I think it's very early to say this, but I have at least attended some discussions on this topic. And for some people, the situation is extremely stressful, while others have less of a problem with restricting them and saying or trying to understand what is the positive side of it. If the world changes, when something changes in a fundamental matter, how to change it in such a way that the outcome is better for a lot of people. I was reading a little bit of Alain Badiou, you may know the French philosopher, and I think these are these cardinal situations, which, to come back to the beginning of our discussion, he thinks they are located in the field of science, in the field of the arts, in politics, for instance, when a revolution starts or something like that, but also in love, the encounter between people. These are the scenarios where very special situations can trigger something which has a huge impact, change on our society. And so Corona will not do it by itself, but we have to think about how we can deal with the situation such that certain problems which would have arise without any change can now be brought into a different direction, something which is good for us. At least that's my hope.
Very often when I talk to the people, it comes really back to listening better or to giving a more close look at things, to be more open and to be more collaborative.
Yes, collaboration. I think that's a very important point. Also, actually, in science, the scientific world is also more and more striving for large data involving many people. I was always interested in artists like Cosima von Bonin or Kai Althoff, who had this process in working with other artists, just as an example. And I think, yeah, there are big chances actually also for the curators and galleries. And I think this will open new possibilities to collaborate and to use this momentum to change this whole system in a way.
Thank you very much, Henning.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.